Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today will stay partly cloudy. There's actually a blowing dust advisory for parts of Maricopa County coming our way from 3 until 7 this afternoon. And we expect more blowing dust tonight. And then for tomorrow, mostly sunny skies with a high of 103. Currently, relative humidity is at 28%. It's partly cloudy and 95 degrees.
The University of Arizona will be looking for a new president. KJZZ's Catherine Fritke has more on today's announcement.
The Arizona Board of Regents has announced U of A President Ann Weaver Hart has provided her notice. In a statement, they say Hart informed them she did not wish to seek an extension to her current contract. Hart says she looks forward to returning as a full-time faculty, teacher, scholar, and citizen of the university. Hart's contract is through June 2017. The Board of Regents says it will conduct a nationwide search for President Hart's replacement. Catherine Fricke, KJZZ News.
A U.S. Border Patrol agent shot dead a man who crossed the border illegally into Arizona. The man allegedly assaulted the agent near Summerton on Thursday night. From the Fronteras desk, KJZZ's Michelle Marisco reports the agent was injured in the incident.
According to officials, the agent fired his weapon while he was being assaulted Thursday night about 10 p.m. A Border Patrol statement issued Friday said the alleged assailant grabbed the agent's radio and his baton and began to hit the agent in the face while he attempted to take the agent's gun from its holster. Both men were taken to Yuma Regional Medical Center, where the alleged assailant was pronounced dead. The agent was injured and required stitches to close at least one wound. He also received a concussion. Another man has been identified. The agent is on administrative leave while Customs and Border Protection's Use of Force Incident Team investigates the shooting. Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, Tucson.
The Tenderfoot Fire continues to burn around Yarnell. The human-caused fire started on Wednesday. KJZZ's Stina Sieg has been covering it, and she joins me. Stina, where are you, and what can you see?
So right now I'm at the Incident Command, which is also the elementary school here in Peoples Valley, and I'm looking at the fire, or what's left of it. It's basically just a whole bunch of smoke, and there's maybe a half dozen little areas that are billowing up smoke, and then there's, you know, helicopters coming by and dropping water on it.
What is the latest on the fire, especially as far as containment goes?
So we're still only at 10%. And it's because they've been containing areas pretty well, but then new areas pop up. So right now they think they're at like 3,300 acres, but I get a sense it's probably going to increase by the end of today.
Stina, there's a new fire team coming in. Can you give us a sense of what they'll be doing?
So there's been like a real new infusion of a lot of people. And right now there's 400 personnel working the fire. And this new team, it's headed by Alan Sinclair. He's the new incident commander. And he said that the previous team did a really great job of, you know, protecting all the valuable assets, you know, protecting the houses, protecting the businesses, protecting the communities. And so now it's his team's job to go out and suppress the fire in this really rugged area.
Sometimes when you're suppressing fire, you got to wait to take action because you have to have a good plan. We're not going to go out there and chase it. We are going to look for strategic locations where it's safe to engage the fire.
Well, Stina, it sounds like firefighters and fire managers are really trying to be very, very careful in this situation.
Yeah, and they're making a point to point that out to people that, you know, they're not going to put anybody into harm's way. You know, the only things they kept on saying over and over was, you know, we have time. Like, this fire is burning, but it's burning in fairly safe areas. And they want to make sure that whatever step they take next, that it's really thought out.
Stina, you had a chance to visit a shelter earlier today in Prescott for evacuees. How many people are there, and how are they doing?
So there's 31 people, and there are 11 dogs and one cat. And the people, you know, they seem pretty upbeat, but they've been dealing with, you know, for 2 days, this sort of hurry up and wait thing, you know, not knowing when they're going to be able to go home or check on their house again. And, you know, they seem fine, but they also seem like they're ready to, you know, get back to their lives. I spoke with Dana Howe, And he's a resident in Yarnell. His home actually was spared last time. And he's been there since Wednesday. And he just seems, you know, he was ready to get back there.
We want to get home. I mean, the Red Cross has been awful good to us, but there's nothing like your own bed.
In the beginning of all this, you know, Howe told me that the first thing he thought of, the first thing that came to his mind was the safety of the firefighters. And when he told me that, he actually choked up a little bit. You know, and now that he's been in the shelter for, you know, more than 2 days, he just feels tired. You know, the first night he was there, he could only get 10 minutes of sleep. And he's kind of like indicative of all the people I've met here who are locals. I mean, they're so appreciative of all of the work that the firefighters have done and, you know, the sheriffs have done, but they're just really ready for this to be over.
That's KJZZ's Stina C. covering the Tenderfoot Fire for us up in northern Arizona. Stina, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Arizona Board of Regents this morning gave its approval to Phase 3 of the Sun Devil Stadium renovation project. The $268 million project is about $12 million more expensive than expected. Joining me with more on that is ASU's Chief Financial Officer, Morgan Olson. And Morgan, what will today's vote by the Regents mean for the overall job?
Well, we've been in the middle of a three-phase project to reinvent Sun Devil Stadium. The first phase was completed before last season. We're in the middle of phase two and looking forward to starting the season in September. And then phase three, which was the subject of the action that the board took today, will commence for the most part just after the season is completed. There's a little bit of work that we think we can do in the course of this season.
And what will that third phase entail?
So the third phase will finish up the east side of the stadium, putting in a new lower bowl, replacing all of the concessions and utilities and sales areas, replacing a good deal of the seating. And we will also complete the construction of the student athlete facility in the north end zone of the stadium.
I know that there have been concerns about some of the cost overruns on this project. To what do you attribute the fact that this project is turning out to be a bit more expensive than you expected?
Sure. So we have been doing the phases, or the project, as I indicated, in three phases. And we did that purposely because we knew that we would be learning things about the stadium. It was built originally in 1958 through the process. Areas that have resulted in our deciding to add some money to the project budget are basically threefold. First of all, we identified during excavation of the stadium in phase two that there were some areas that had soil conditions that would not support the reconstruction of the stadium. So there was excavation that was unanticipated, and then replacement with new fill in that area. The second item is when we got an opportunity to actually look at the condition of the lower bowl during the phase one reconstruction, it was discovered that the deterioration in some areas of the lower bowl were greater than had been anticipated. And so we could have kept the lower bowl in place, but we knew that in sometime in the next 5 to 10 years that it would be necessary to completely replace the entire lower bowl. And so we decided that the appropriate thing to do at this point was to go ahead and replace the west side in phase two. And, of course, we'll go ahead and now do the east side in phase three so that we'll have an entire new lower bowl.
Do you have concerns that you might find some stuff that you're not expecting in this third phase and it might turn out to be more expensive than you thought as well?
You know, that's always possible. We don't think so. We've got a great team working on the stadium, and so we have you know, confidence that we've identified the things that require attention here. And so, no, we expect that this will now represent the full cost of the project over all three phases.
And how will the university pay for the money that you didn't anticipate having to spend originally?
Well, that's a bit of good news. When we put together the plan of finance for the project, we made certain assumptions about the cost of capital. We're borrowing around $200 million that we will pay back over time, you know, through a bond issue. And the cost of capital, interest rates have been so low that we will actually be able to cover that additional $12.7 million without increasing the debt service that was in our original plan.
Morgan Olson is ASU's chief financial officer. We spoke with him from Flagstaff, where he's attending the Board of Regents meeting. The board this morning voted to approve phase three of the Sun Devil Stadium renovation project. Morgan, thank you very much.
My pleasure. You have a great day.
As we enter the summer months, all eyes are on Lake Mead and the ongoing drought in the Colorado River Basin. While it doesn't look like Arizona will face water cutbacks next year, there's a good chance it will in the coming years. And that means the cost of water will go up. In fact, just this week, cities in central Arizona were told they'd start paying more for Colorado River water even sooner. KJZZ's Will Stone joins us now with more. And Will, what happened this week?
Steve, this week, the Central Arizona Project, the CAP, and they're the government entity responsible for piping in Arizona's water from Lake Mead. We see their canals around. And they voted to raise one of the charges that cities have to pay for their water, called the capital charge. And basically, that's the source of revenue that helps the CAP pay back its debt to the federal government for building the massive canal system in the first place. That costed billions of dollars. And every year, the CAP has to pay back some of its debt to the feds, about $55 million a year. And it turns out in recent years, CAP has had some trouble making that payment, and they've started dipping into their reserves. And it's gone to a point where the reserves are well below what they should be, and CAP has to make that money up some way. So they approved a substantial rate hike to do that.
All right, well, let's define what substantial means.
So after considering many different options, the board voted to raise the rates from its current level, which is $23 an acre foot, to $31 starting in next year. And then for the year after, preliminarily, it would go up to $49. So, you know, it's more than doubling of that rate. And that's something that cities will have to deal with. I spoke with CAP General Manager Ted Cook, and he said, you know what, we should have been raising these rates a long time ago.
We could have been there by now if we would have had the guts to begin to bring that rate up closer to where it needed to be. So shame on us. It is increasing. It's increasing by a lot. And I know this doesn't make it any better for anybody, but the rate needs to be $50.
So why did Central Arizona Project find itself in this bad financial position in the first place?
Yeah, it's a confluence of factors, Steve, but a big one is actually the energy market, interestingly. CAP runs the Navajo Generating Station, and that helps them move all the water from, you know, down into Central Arizona. But they also have a lot of excess power, and they sell that on the energy market, and that brings in revenue, and that's helped them meet these debt costs that they have. But in recent years, as the price of natural gas has plummeted, the revenue from that has dropped significantly. So they've started to look at other pots of money.
And as we've seen, El Nino did not pan out as people had hoped. So the drought is persisting. So could we see water rates keep going up because of that?
Yes, that is pretty much inevitable as long as the drought is going on. Because if you think about it, first of all, you have less water, so just the cost of water will go up. But also, there'll be less water running through the canals, but all those expenses linked to the infrastructure, the fixed costs, as utilities usually call them, they stay the same. And CAP will have to make up that money that they're not getting. So under some scenarios, the price will go up about 50% for CAP, and that will get passed along to their customers. So Arizona has been in talks with its neighboring states, California and Nevada, and they're brokering a deal that would mean Arizona would give up more water sooner than we had anticipated. It's part of an effort to avert an even more critical, serious shortage later on. And so by leaving more water in Lake Mead, we could actually stop even greater cutbacks. But this also means that in the meantime, some people are going to have to give up water sooner than they anticipated. That could be the cities, that could be the farmers, anyone who gets that Colorado River water. And so now water officials, state officials are going around the state and trying to come up with some kind of consensus that they will eventually then bring to the legislature where they're going to come up with this extra, you know, more than 100,000 acre feet of water.
KJZZ's Will Stone with the latest on the Central Arizona Project. Will, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
So now we know the Central Arizona Project is trying to raise more money to pay back its debt to federal officials. But how does the CAP itself get water to its customers from a technical standpoint? Here to explain that is Tom McCann, CAP's Deputy General Manager for Operations and Maintenance. Tom, lay out the basics. How does the CAP system of canals work?
It's a 336-mile system running from the Colorado River at Lake Havasu, east and south across the central part of the state. We actually sort of skirt the north and eastern sides of the Phoenix metropolitan area and then turn south and head down by Tucson, the endpoint of the canal is just a little south and west of Tucson. It's a series of pumping plants that lift the water. Essentially, we lift it to a point where gravity can take over for as long as the terrain allows, and then we need to relift again and then let it flow by gravity. So there's a total of 15 pumping plants that lift the water in stages. The largest is the first plant at the river, what we call our Mark Wilmer pumping plant. We have 6 units there that are each 60,000 horsepower and can move about 3,600 cubic feet of water per second.
Is it kind of amazing that it works this way?
It took a lot of engineering, and there were a lot of really smart people that helped design the project. But when you get down to it, it is just engineering. Each of the pumping plants is designed to optimize the size of the units and the volume that's being moved at that location and the amount of lift that's required. The surveyors that spent I don't know how much time out surveying a route to find a route that would give them just the right amount of gradual slope. I think the slope's actually about, if I remember right, about a half a foot a mile. So if you think about it, over the course of a mile, you're only dropping at 6 inches. That's pretty good surveying that's required there.
And how much water are we talking about on a regular basis, whether it's on a daily basis that gets pushed through the system?
The system was designed to move at least 1.5 million acre feet a year. An acre foot is the unit we use because otherwise gallons are way too big. An acre foot is 325,851 gallons. It's enough to cover an acre of water 1 foot deep. We have long-term contracts for a little more than 1.4 million acre feet of water a year. In recent years, we've been moving about 1.6 million acre feet off the river each year and into central Arizona, either for direct delivery to customers or for storing it underground.
Tom McCann is the Deputy General Manager for Operations and Maintenance for the Central Arizona Project.
Pima County's Consolidated Justice Court will be in session tomorrow and is encouraging residents with outstanding warrants to show up to have those warrants quashed. Maria Felix is Chief Administrative Judge for the Pima County Consolidated Justice Court. And Judge Felix, what will be going on tomorrow?
Yes, in an effort to reduce the number of warrants, because we have over 20,000 outstanding warrants dating back to 1990, we thought we would hold Saturday warrant court to help our residents address their warrants. We're holding it on a Saturday to help those who work, who cannot get out of work or go to school. That way they can address their warrants and proceed with their criminal matters.
What kinds of crimes have these folks typically committed?
Oh, gosh, that depends. It could be DUIs, it could be driving on a suspended license. It could be failure to comply with their sentence requirements. So it's just a lot of reasons for their warrants.
So for folks who have these outstanding warrants, they go to the court on Saturday. What happens to them once they get there?
It's going to be like just any other day. So they proceed to the appropriate courtroom. We're going to have full staff on Saturdays. We're going to have 4 judges from our court, from the justice court, and they can expect to come to the courtroom. Their case will be called. We're going to have their record on the court's bench, and then the judges are going to hear these cases and quash the warrant. If there are any outstanding issues, such as payment plan that needs to be reinstated, we will address that. Or classes that have to be taken that weren't taken, we will most likely give them an extension to provide proof of compliance with their sentence requirements. So the main goal is to quash warrants, to quash as many warrants as we possibly can.
What is the best case scenario for the number of those 20,000 active warrants you have that you might be able to process through on Saturday?
Oh, goodness. We're going to try to reach as many as possible.
Do you have an estimate in mind, like a way to gauge success? Like if we get this number of folks in and get through this number of warrants, we will have had a successful day.
Oh, sure. Tucson City Court did a warrant court such as this, and on their first warrant court on a Saturday, I think they got about 500 or a little over 500 people appearing. So I think we can handle 500 people appearing on Saturday without a problem. So we're hoping to at least get that many.
Maria Felix is the Chief Administrative Judge for Pima County Consolidated Justice Court. Judge Felix, thank you very much.
And thank you for listening.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick, I'm Steve Goldstein. Congress passed the Toxic Substance Control Act back in 1976. It was designed to regulate the chemical industry and potentially dangerous substances that go into industrial processes, household items, even toys. But from the perspective of environmental and health groups, that law became all but toothless. The court said in 1991 that TSCA, as it's known in D.C., doesn't even apply to asbestos, a known cause of cancer.
But now, 40 years later, Congress has agreed to some reform. The Senate passed an updated bill this week. The House overwhelmingly passed it earlier this month, and now it heads to the president for his signature. Democratic California Senator Barbara Boxer negotiated the bill. She says she held out for the best regulation she could get.
I used every prerogative that I had, every tool in my arsenal, to bring it down until it got better. And it is better. It is better than current law.
Better, says Barbara Boxer, but how good, really? The new bill allows for testing on the more than 64,000 chemicals currently unregulated by TSCA in everything from household cleaners to flame retardants in furniture. But is better than current law, as Senator Boxer said, good enough? Scott Faber is vice president of the government affairs for the Environmental Working Group, a nonprofit environmental research organization. Scott Faber, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
Well, under the updated bill that's going to become law, what gets tested now and what doesn't?
Well, Senator Boxer's right in that the bill will be better than current law, but that's not saying much since it's widely recognized as the worst environmental law in the books. What will happen, what's good about this bill, is EPA will now be able to order companies to provide basic data about chemicals, how toxic they are, what they're used in. And EPA will have to review new chemicals before they enter the marketplace. About 700 enter the marketplace every year. And EPA will have to slowly begin to review the backlog of old chemicals that have been on the marketplace for decades, some of which have been linked to cancer and other serious health problems.
And many of which have been grandfathered from the start. Even when the original TSCA passed 40 years ago, there were chemicals that were never tested that are in our homes every day.
That's right. And one of the reasons that groups like EWG and others don't support the bill is that the pace of reviewing those old grandfathered chemicals is really just too slow. You know, it's certainly fair to say this law is better than the law that was passed in 1976. But really the right question we ought to be asking is this law, does it really reflect what consumers expect? And I think an ordinary person would say, gosh, all the dangerous chemicals, all the chemicals that have been linked to cancer and reproductive problems and neurological problems ought to be quickly reviewed and regulated or even banned if necessary. And unfortunately, this bill just won't meet that standard.
And so it's important to point out that even though this is better, they're still not testing chemicals like in the way the FDA tests a new drug, right? If you make a new drug for cancer or anything else, you have to do human trials, clinical trials before you can sell it. That's not happening here.
That's exactly right. And ultimately, the question of whether companies will even have to test chemicals and report that information to EPA depends on the EPA that's in charge. If there's a good EPA, an aggressive EPA that gets lots of money from Congress, then we might quickly get through the most dangerous chemicals in a generation. We might quickly review and regulate chemicals that have been linked to cancer in a few years. But if we get a bad EPA or Congress decides not to provide the money, well, you know, we might not make very much progress at all.
Well, let me ask you about industry before I let you go, Scott Faber. Industry likes this bill. They're happy with it. The lobbyists like it. What's here? What's in here for them to like?
Well, first and foremost, this bill puts new obstacles in the way of states. States have been the only cops on the chemical beat for decades. More than 30 states have acted to restrict or even ban chemicals that have been linked to serious problems like cancer. And this bill puts some new hurdles in the way of states. That's important to industry. But in one important respect, this bill doesn't give industry what it wants. It doesn't restore consumer confidence in the chemicals that are in our carpets and couches. And by doing so, that means that regulators, retail regulators, Walmart, Target, big retailers will continue to use their power to drive dangerous chemicals out of products, at least until EPA can prove that they're the better new cop on the beat.
Well, the Toxic Substance Control Act has passed Congress. It's headed to the president. The chemical industry gets rid of state regulations that give them a mosaic and a patchwork to deal with. They get to deal with one set of regulations, and the story is not yet written, says Scott Faber, about whether this new law truly protects consumers. Scott Faber is vice president for government affairs at the Environmental Working Group. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Todd.
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway.
There are more than 27,000 people experiencing homelessness in Arizona, and for many of them, going to the doctor is the last thing on their minds. But a group of college students is changing that. The show's Lauren Gilger takes us to the Human Services campus in downtown Phoenix, where the homeless come for a hot meal and a bed.
So this is a teaching team, and so...
It's early on a Saturday morning when a lot of college students are probably still sleeping.
We have occupational therapy here, nursing here, physical therapy, and medicine, and psych.
But Pooja Powday and about a dozen other students from all over Arizona are seeing their first patient of the day.
You see a patient, and then you go back to your huddle. You discuss as a team how to approach the patient's care, and then you actually go and take care of the patient.
They are the students behind SHOW, or Student Health Outreach for Wellness, an interprofessional free healthcare clinic for the homeless in downtown Phoenix.
He does have high blood pressure, and he used to take medication for the blood pressure, but he no longer does. It was slightly elevated, 137 over 77.
SHOW is the first Tri-State University student-led clinic in Arizona. Patients here are treated by students from all three state universities and providers who volunteer their time here every Saturday to help.
The other symptom is like headache and dizziness, he said.
Yes, but we think it's more attributed to the heat.
They fill up the county's health care for the homeless clinic's facilities when they're empty on the weekends. And in their first year open, they've treated over 1,100 patients who come in from the crowded county shelter just outside their doors.
People will come in with like 10 chief complaints, like related to back pain, chronic pain, a lot of chronic conditions that just go unmanaged because of their situation.
Since 2013, more than 150 students from 16 professional programs at all three state universities have volunteered their time here. Students studying everything from nursing, nutrition, and medicine to social work, business, and journalism. To Powday, they fill an important void.
Any other time that's not Mondays to Fridays, like business hours, the patients don't have anywhere to go, and so they'll go to the emergency department.
She says in one semester, EMS workers in the county reported that SHOW likely saved more than $30,000 by diverting patients who would have otherwise gone to the ER.
And it's actually not going to help them in the long run, because it's not like you, when you go to the emergency room, it's not like patient-centered care. They just take care of whatever your issue is and you go.
Powday has been involved with the clinic since almost the very beginning.
I started wanting to be a physician, and it's something my parents had told me. Everyone was like, oh, we gotta have a doctor in the family.
She worked in an emergency department for a while.
I enjoyed it, but I always saw it from like a systems perspective where I was like, I think there's a better way we can do this.
She just graduated from Barrett Honors College at ASU, and now she's working at SHOW coordinating development and research. And she says she's looking toward a career in healthcare policy.
So for them, it's really the leadership development that I see in them.
Dr. Liz Harrell helped found the SHOW Clinic in 2014, and she's the program director here. She says the students who spend time here gain more than a line on their resumes.
It's also this greater understanding of how healthcare works in America right now and how to move forward towards better national care.
That's why Harrell designed the clinic as interprofessional integrated care.
So because we have an interprofessional team, a patient might see an occupational therapist, a physical therapist, and a medical student, and nursing preceptors all in the same day.
And they integrate medical and mental health care. Harrell says these students will shape the future of health care in our country.
So I'm hoping that they will be the change agents then as they move forward. They will understand the benefits of working together, and as they move out, they will demand that as they set up their own practices and work in practices.
In Phoenix, Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
In KJZZ News, a movie production will shut down part of the northern stretch of Loop 303 for several days. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Casey Kuhn reports drivers will need to find another route.
Paramount Pictures is filming the next Transformers action movie, the fifth in the franchise. Arizona Department of Transportation says Loop 303 between Lake Pleasant Parkway and I-17 will be closed until late Wednesday. Officials say the detours will be on State Route 74, 2 miles north of Loop 303. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
If you're looking for artists, musicians, chefs, or any other talented creative people, the Valley's become a pretty good haven for them. And every couple of years, Phoenix New Times unveils a list of the 100 creatives. The countdown will continue until the publication has its Best of the Valley edition in September. With me to talk about it is the person who chooses the creatives, Becky Bartkowski, the New Times culture editor. So, Becky, how broad is the realm you're picking from?
This year we've had a nail artist, we've had a theater director, we have a woman who's a zine artist. It's all over the map. And the goal really is to just put a spotlight on people doing fascinating creative things in the Valley that we might not have known about, that our readers might not have known about, but that we wholeheartedly endorse.
So obviously in this case, creative is a noun. So when you think of a creative, what comes to mind for you? It doesn't have to be a field, but what sort of qualities does that person have?
I think a creative is someone who's doing something that satisfies them and isn't necessarily looking at a bottom line. I think that about satisfies it. Though a lot of these people are quite successful at what they do. I don't want to insinuate otherwise.
So does creativity have to be something that someone else hasn't done before? Or is it maybe just someone putting their own unique spin on it?
I perceive creativity as someone bringing their unique self to whatever the activity or medium or what have you is. For instance, I mean, Ron May of Stray Cat Theater, he's hilarious. He's a great interview. And he gave really insightful answers to our questionnaire, which is something we issue for every creative. We submit a set of questions to them, and they can respond however they like. So I think in addition to kind of deep diving on what they do, it's interesting to see how different people in different fields respond to the same set of questions.
And that is at the point where you've already decided this person's going to be on the list, or do you have more than 100 names, or do you think these are the 100 ultimately I would like to see on this list?
Here's what I do. I keep an email draft all year. And I'm adding to it every single time I see someone who I think, oh, I love that. I love what they're doing. And maybe right now isn't the perfect time to write about them. Maybe there's not a timely aspect to it or whatever. But I really want to put a spotlight on them and talk with them about what they're doing. So that's kind of my methodology for it. It is not super organized, I'll give you that, but it is a cool way to keep track of people and to remind myself of people I've seen who have done cool things.
Does a creative have to come from what we would call the arts? Can it be something in another field that if you stretch it a little bit, it's artistic, but it's not necessarily in what we consider sculpting, dance, etc.?
Oh, sure. One person I profiled this year, his name's Danny Newman. He's an action figure anthropologist. Truly.
Oh, okay. Action figure anthropologist. Okay.
Yes.
How does one do the anthropology of an action figure? I had a $6 million man when I was a kid. I'm not sure there was much to his anthropology. I didn't think.
So this creative, he's a designer by day, and his passion is action figures. He collects them. He's obsessed with like sci-fi, fantasy, pop culture stuff. He loves Star Wars. And he's actually started this Instagram series called Super Newmans, where he has modified G.I. Joe action figures. And every day he posts a quote-unquote portrait of their lives, posing them in various ways, adding a storyline. And I mean, if that's not creative, I truly don't know what is.
Do you already know who's on the list?
I would say I know probably 90% of the rest of the list, but I do like to keep it fresh, and not everyone who I am hoping will be on the list knows that they'll be on it yet. I like to keep it a little bit fresh and surprising. So fingers crossed they all pan out.
Becky Bartkowski of Phoenix New Times. We've been talking about the publication's list of 100 creatives in the Valley, and we'll be hearing from some of those creatives in the weeks ahead on the show.
How can the Valley unlock its entrepreneurial potential? That was the topic of a discussion this week, sponsored by the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce and ASU. For more on this, I'm joined by Sethuraman Panchanathan, who also goes by Ponch. He's Executive Vice President of the ASU Knowledge Enterprise and Chief Research and Innovation Officer at ASU. And Ponch, how do you unlock entrepreneurship in the Valley?
Yeah, the first thing that we need to do, Mark, is to identify those communities where rich talent is, you know, there, and how might we turn the talent into significant outcomes.
So from your perspective, would ASU sort of be the glue that brings all of these people together and these different communities together and sort of gets them out on the right foot?
Yes, ASU can be a significant asset in this front in the following manner. We already have several entrepreneurial programs that we offer for our faculty and students, and some to the community too, that brings good ideas in connection with potential funding. And the greatest challenge, as you can imagine, is getting funding for your ideas. And how might we develop these ideas into a form that can attract funding and therefore then be able to realize the dream of a successful entrepreneurial activity?
With a state university, though, I would imagine that there are certain rules and regulations, things you have to do, things you can't do, that maybe in the private sector are not such an issue. Does that pose any challenges to startups?
No, not at all, because what we are trying to do as a university is we take our responsibility for, you know, the vibrant economic ecosystem that Arizona is becoming increasingly. We take our responsibility to make that possible. We don't see this as in any way in conflict with anything. We believe that, on the other hand, that we are a neutral place where people can comfortably discuss their ideas and see how might they get the help to realize their ideas into impact and in economic outcomes.
What do you think ultimately is the potential for entrepreneurship in the Valley? I mean, does this have the potential to be a place like Austin, like Silicon Valley, like some of the other places that are really known worldwide?
Absolutely. I'm firmly convinced, Mark, we are a large community. We are a diverse community, but we are a community that essentially is highly interconnected. While we are big, we are also small in the sense that we are able to talk to each other without any inhibitions whatsoever. And we also take our job. And in any successful community like this, you want to have a university that is willing to be a partner, willing to be an enabler. And therefore, with all of this, I think we as a community are well positioned to be a very successful community moving forward. And that's basically what we're trying to do here.
What kind of timeline do you think is realistic to look at for the Phoenix area becoming really this hotbed of entrepreneurship?
I would think, I mean, we're already starting to look, you know, more and more like some of the places that you talked about. But I would expect, you know, if we have a concerted effort in 3 to 5 years, we would definitely have a place which is very, very vibrant and would be talked like how you talk about the places like Austin or Silicon Valley and others.
Would Phoenix as an entrepreneurial capital look different than other cities as entrepreneurial capitals?
I would think so, Mark, because that's why this effort that we are taking right now is extremely important, because we don't just take entrepreneurship with the viewpoint that it is only about tech firms or biotech firms or things of that nature. We are looking at the entire spectrum of entrepreneurship. You know, it could be a person who is trying to take their ideas and build a better laundromat. It can be a person that is trying to build a better school or whatever that might be that we are trying to do in the community, that we'll have a spectrum of entrepreneurial ideas that will thrive in Arizona. And because of the diversity of the population that we have here, the fantastic Native American community, the Latino community, the significant number of women entrepreneurs that we have here, and if you take the diversity of the communities that exist here, you will find that turning them into successful entrepreneurs, we will look different that way.
Sethuraman Panchanathan is Executive Vice President of the ASU Knowledge Enterprise and Chief Research and Innovation Officer at ASU.
The U.S. manufacturing industry has lost thousands of jobs to overseas outsourcing or offshoring, and other positions have seen humans gobbled up by robots. The longstanding trend is happening in other countries, too. Apple supplier Foxconn recently dropped 60,000 jobs and replaced the workers with robots. Joseph Carter, supply chain management professor at ASU's Thunderbird School of Global Management, studies the topic, and he joins me now. Professor Carter, could we actually see some high-skilled tech jobs return to the U.S. because of the increases in robotics and automation?
There's two things going on here. One is the trend towards automation, and that's inexorable. I mean, you'd be pushing water uphill to not see that trend continue. So there's not really anything we can do about that. Amazon is putting robotics into all of their warehouses in the United States, so hundreds and hundreds of them. So there will be a replacement of lower-skilled workforce. There's no question about that. But what will happen for a society like the United States is that for every robot, they'll be hiring people who are computer scientists to do the programming. They'll be hiring people who are engineers to design the robots and the layout. And there'll be people who will be hired to maintain those robots and put them back to work, so to speak. What will happen is there'll be fewer jobs in the warehouses or otherwise because of automation, but productivity will increase, which is an important point to remember, and higher wage jobs will be created. If any economy, whether it's the Chinese economy, the American, Indian, or whatever, does not increase productivity at a reasonable rate, 2 or 3%, the general economy and society just won't create new jobs. So if automation is just to replace jobs with no increase in productivity, then I'd be concerned. If automation is being input into these plants and warehouses with the idea that productivity will begin to skyrocket or increase, then in general, the tide will raise all boats and we'll get a net increase in employment.
So is this the kind of thing then would bring certain jobs back to the U.S. that had left? Is that also going to be a disincentive for certain companies to move so many jobs, whether outsourcing or some other form?
I think it will bring some jobs back, and automation has brought some jobs back. Where jobs were rarely outsourced, offshored, and oriented around a decrease in labor cost, that advantage is leaving. It's disappearing. So not outsourcing, but offshoring trend has moderated and some jobs have been moving back. The automation could continue that trend. I don't think it'll ever stop it. There will be offshoring. And the main reason for that is today it's moved beyond just labor. Companies need to locate their operations where they expect their markets to be, not just today, but in the next 2 or 3 years. So they want to be close to the customer.
In the days when people kept working for one company for 30, 40, however many years it was, it seemed like there were more built-in sort of training components to it. As we've gotten to the point of technology advancing and competition growing ever faster in places like China, India, wherever it may be, are we seeing less opportunities for a person to learn more about, let's say, the growing technology from his or her own company? Is that on a worker to try to learn as much as they possibly can to move forward, whether it's about robotics, automation, or whatnot? Or is that basically a dead end in and of itself?
Steve, I think you hit right upon it in a very important point. 20, 30, 40 years ago, the basic training which went into advancing technology occurred at the company site. So as we were trending towards computerization, and it seems like a long time ago, but it really wasn't. The major trend happened probably in 1980, or late 70s, when it really took off. Companies would provide a lot of training. Today, companies, for whatever reason, have put the responsibility for upskilling workforce and society in two hands. One, into the workers themselves, and two, into the government. I guess it's the general trend towards continuing education over the entire life of the worker.
Joseph Carter, a supply chain management professor at ASU's Thunderbird School of Global Management. We've been talking about the growing use of robotics and automation and the impact on workers.
The Muslim holy month of Ramadan began this week. The month signifies the beginning of the revelation of the Quran to the Prophet Muhammad. Muslims around the world observe the month by praying, listening to recitations of the Quran, practicing charity, and by not eating or drinking during daylight hours. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry reports on what that means for Muslims in the Arizona desert.
A few days before Ramadan began, Angelica Lindsay Ali and her family were busy making decorations and talking about the ways they plan to celebrate.
Yeah, my sister made a sign.
It's like having Christmas and Thanksgiving and Easter and New Year's all rolled into one, but for 30 days.
If you don't observe Ramadan, that might not be what you expect, since everyone is fasting over long, hot days. It's true, the fast isn't always easy. Here's Lindsay Ali.
It's difficult, but if you go in it with the right intention, it's not as hard as everybody makes it seem. It's not that you're depriving your body of food. I like to say that you're making space in your mind and your body for God.
This idea is central to understanding Ramadan. While non-Muslims may focus on the difficulty of the fast or the fact that not drinking water during a desert summer is often ill-advised, many Muslims will quickly point out that the fast is only one part of observing.
It's a time for complete peace. It's the religion, it's the Holy Quran, it's everything coming alive in the people, in the motion.
Azra Mahmood lives in the valley and grew up Muslim, but connected most strongly with Ramadan during college when she lived in Kentucky and she didn't know many other Muslims nearby.
I found Islam and Ramadan to be most engaging when I was in solitude, when I actually was very alone and didn't have a community to fast or to break fast with or to, you know, enjoy all the rituals that we do.
Mahmood says the act of fasting helped her connect with her spirituality and her identity as a Muslim. And she began to find community, first with non-Muslim friends who would fast in solidarity with her and eventually with other Muslims on campus. At the Islamic Community Center of Phoenix, or ICCP, many people come to observe the holy month as part of the community. On the first night after the fast, a few dozen people anxiously wait for the time to eat. They're sitting around tables with cups of water and bowls of dates on them.
We bought 30 cases yesterday, so there's a lot. That's 330 pounds.
That's Usama Shami, president of the ICCP. And in case you missed it, that's 330 pounds of dates. It's traditional to break the fast with 1, 3, or 5 dates and some water. Then there are prayers, followed by a complete meal called iftar. Rosie Barra is one of the women gathering in a small classroom to eat dinner after fasting for at least 15 hours. Plates are filled with chicken, rice, and salad. And even though she's very hungry, she doesn't eat until she said hi to everyone she knows in the room.
I like to be close to my sisters, you know, to feel that the happiness.
Barra converted to Islam just over a year ago. She grew up in Mexico and is the only one in her family that is Muslim. She says she was searching for something deeper when she found the religion.
When I hear Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, I start crying. And I understand that that was God calling me to Islam.
Now that she's here, she's happy to fast because Ramadan means so much to her.
Ramadan is, like I say, it's like a refresh. You refresh your soul, you refresh your spirit. It is something very, very beautiful. It's amazing.
After dinner, more and more people begin to trickle into the mosque, many of them carrying bottles of water and ready to join in nighttime prayers. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.